The Guardian.
Would you like to unlock the secrets of great science writing?
Science writers actually have to find a way of converting very complex ideas into something the rest of the world can understand.
Well, the great science writer Tim Radford can help you do just that. I'll tell you more after the podcast.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
Over time, the hair started falling out. Mawson's soles of his feet famously fell off. He had to strap them on with lanolin every morning.
The soles of his feet
fell off.
Will we ever tire of tales of polar exploration? I don't think so. To add to the growing feast of great stories, I'll be meeting Professor Chris Turney and discussing his epic book, 1912, the year the world discovered Antarctica. Also on the show, we'll be looking at this week's science news. Stories including how George Osborne's got interested in science and how the Neanderthals made some very vicious weapons. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. To kick things off this week, we're going to go straight into the news. Joining me to discuss that is Ian Sample, The Guardian science correspondent. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Alok.
How interested are you in science funding, Ian? Science funding, science policy? You've written a story this week, which we'll come to in a second. Tell me, how interested are you in all of this?
I think of little else.
Okay. Well, you'll be happy to know that George Osborne, the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, he made his first ever science speech just last week. It was at the Royal Society. And here he is talking about his love for scientific endeavour.
As Chancellor, it's my job too to focus on the economic benefits of scientific excellence. But I do that understanding that scientific inquiry can't be reduced to simple utilitarian calculation, even though improving the human condition is a pretty good justification for any human endeavour. Intellectual inquiry is worthwhile in itself, and the flourishing of communication about science in the media is evidence that this hunger to understand the world is more intense and more widespread than ever. You do not necessarily become a scientist to boost GDP, even though it is a very welcome consequence of much of what you do. And we must leave room for original research and abstract intellectual inquiry. For even when it is abstract and theoretical, it does not flourish in isolation. David Hume put it very well in his great essay of the refinement in the arts. And he said this: "The same age which produces great philosophers and politicians, renowned generals and poets, usually abounds with skillful weavers and ship carpenters. We cannot reasonably expect that a piece of woolen cloth will be wrought to perfection in a nation which is ignorant of astronomy. In the long run, it is technical change which determines our economic growth. We become more productive, not by more back-breaking labour, but by working with more knowledge in our heads and more equipment in our hands. That knowledge and that equipment are achieved through scientific and technological advance. A recent CBI study found that the quality of our scientific research base is one of the most significant factors encouraging international companies to bring high-value investment here. And innovation is not a sausage machine. You don't get it by a plan imposed by government, and you can't measure it just by counting patents or even just spend on research and development. It's all about creative interactions between science and business. You get innovation when great universities, leading-edge science, world-class companies, and entrepreneurial startups come together. Where they cluster together, you get some of the most exciting places on the planet. And that is where you find the creative ferment which drives a modern dynamic economy. And this government is backing them because that is how we in Great Britain are going to pay our way in a tough and competitive world. And that's why we will continue to support science. Indeed, I'm up for the challenge set by Brian Cox and others of making Britain the best place in the world to do science."
George Osborne there, the UK's Chancellor of the Exchequer, making his first ever speech on science. And he did it at the Royal Society. A very good speech and, you know, witty in parts. He wanted to outline eight areas of technology that he thinks Britain can do really well in, can be world leaders in, and eventually create money and businesses in a way that we can get ourselves out of these recessions that we find ourselves in. These eight areas include things like big data. This is the amount of lots and lots of data collected from science experiments, from meteorology, all these things, and the infrastructure, electronic and computing infrastructure you need to actually process and analyze this stuff. That's an area for the future, potentially, where we can make money. Synthetic biology, we've discussed many a time on this podcast. Regenerative medicine, the idea of regrowing parts of your body or making your heart heal, places that are brand new in science, stem cells, that kind of thing. Agricultural science, the storage of energy, advanced materials, things like metamaterials, which are the things behind invisibility cloaks, nanotechnology, robotics and autonomous systems. And then the most important one for his speech was space technology. This is space satellites, etc., which he says are an important part of the UK economy. Apparently, even in the last few years, they have increased, the industry has increased by 8% per year despite the recession, and is worth about £9 billion every year. I mean, our satellite industry is famous around the world. He wants it to be a £30 billion industry by 2030. So, very directed sort of areas for research, very directed areas for science. I mean, those are the headline bullet points, Ian. I mean, does any of that... it's quite welcoming, isn't it, that he's doing this in the first place?
I think I have to be positive about it, and it's easy to be cynical. I mean, you can look at things like saying he's put money, and some of it's new money, into space industry, and that is one thing where you can look at the UK and say the space industry is something that's definitely growing. It is something where we're making money from it. The other areas are a mix of very broad, interesting areas that are definitely going to be good areas to put money into and good areas to develop in terms of trying to improve the economy. Some of them seemed a little bit sort of, oh, this is very shiny, like synthetic biology. We know synthetic biology has enormous potential, but I don't know how soon people expect to make money from synthetic biology. Regenerative medicine is something which the UK is good on, and it was really nice to hear him talk about that. But
especially given Robert Gurdon's won the Nobel Prize for essentially starting that whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Many years ago.
And he mentioned graphene. He mentioned other kinds of advanced materials. All of these things, we know in this area are exciting and such. Like, and
they
have
are
huge potential.
They are incredibly broad. I mean, the question, I suppose, is what's he going to back this up with? Because this is essentially a read out aloud essay about how good British science is, and and we talk about those sorts of things all the time. The question is, has he backed any of it with money? And the only actual new money in the entire policy announcement last week was £60 million a year for 5 years for the space industry. This is going to be extra money going into the European Space Agency so that we can take a bigger part of the stuff they do. And in return, the European Space Agency is going to site its European centre, headquarters for monitoring all of its satellites, so climate change satellites, telecommunication satellites, everything, into Harwell in Oxfordshire, which is becoming a sort of science park. And so I think Osborne is interested in that sort of deal where you say, if we can step up to the plate and actually fund more international collaborations, then we get stuff in return. It's a bit like CERN as well. You fund more internationally, but then the benefits actually sit in the UK still.
I mean, this is my thinking on this, is that great, the money for space is there, but you don't change the economy, you don't make money for the UK by standing up and saying there are lots of areas of science and technology that are really interesting. You can give a speech, but so what? How does that actually change anything? And I think we are expecting more money in one or two of those areas to come in the near future. But it strikes me as this is a first move by George Osborne.
It's a calling card, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's something that you'll hold up in the future to look at and say, come on, you said these areas were areas of interest and areas of actual urgency. But at the moment, it's really just flagging up what they are. It's not doing anything to actually make the UK any better. The UK is not going to be any better tomorrow or next month about doing any of these things, apart from maybe the space industry.
I suppose the recognition is the important thing. And in politics, that's quite important for the rest of government, and also the fact that it maybe gives business some confidence. But as you say, the money is the important thing. Paul Nurse, the president of the Royal Society, gave some comments straight after the speech and welcomed it. He said it was very encouraging to hear him say all these things, but he said, thank you very much for your speech. Now put your money where your mouth mouth is, and that's essentially all you need to say about it, really. But Ian, hasn't been the only funding science policy type story that was interesting this week. You wrote something which indicated that perhaps the government's commitment to freezing the science budget, which was heralded in big terms last year, isn't quite what it seems.
Well, it's always difficult when you're looking at figures because they can be compiled in different ways, and people sort of rack up different aspects of the science budget in different ways, and capital expenditure gets pulled out or left in and what have you. But the figures that actually a colleague of ours got, Juliet Jowett, the figures that she got via the shadow science minister, Chionwura, from the House of Commons Library here in the UK, showed what were probably concerning figures, in that the latest figures they have were for science spending by government in the year 2010-2011. So this was the first year the coalition came in. And they showed that, as expected, there was an erosion of the science budget due to inflation. But there were also cuts that came in at the department level, where the government departments have been cutting across the board, essentially, their own internal budgets for various reasons. And that gives you an extra hit on the amount of science that's being done in the UK, because the government departments fund an awful lot of it. And the bottom figure you end up with is about 6.4% decline when you actually adjust for inflation. So it's not a good sign. I mean, this was always sort of on the cards. We knew this was coming, but to get some figures on it, I think, helps show what the problem is at the moment. And it really raises the issue and makes us want to have a look out for these kinds of cuts continuing in the future, because if they do continue, then obviously it doesn't take long for those kinds of cuts to add up to something substantial in the years coming.
In addition, of course, in the previous comprehensive spending review, science escaped the big cuts. It was flat cash, essentially, which meant that it wasn't going to be cut, but it didn't get any more. But in real terms, that means over the next 2 years of the spending review cycle, that because inflation's at 2.5% every year, the amount of money they have is worth 2.5% less. And especially when it comes to high-tech industries and high-tech research, cutting-edge laboratories, that inflation figure is nominally quite a bit higher than that. So there is a cut going on, and something that that George Osborne, despite his obvious fascination and fandom for science, needs to be addressing. Ian, let's move on to another story now. This one is about Neanderthals. We've learnt a lot about Neanderthals in the past few years, especially since the genome was sequenced. I mean, they're not the knuckle-dragging beasts that maybe they once were. Certainly, they were intelligent to some degree, and they mated with our ancestors. And so, you know, many of us have some portion of Neanderthal genes in us. This particular story, though, is another one about humans somehow wiping them out.
Yeah, I guess you can look at it that way. But it's a fascinating discovery. This was all coming from an excavation happening on a cliff face overlooking the ocean on the southern coast of South Africa. And the researchers found more than 70 of these very distinctive sharp stone tips. And these are bits of stone that have been gathered and then heat treated. You heat treat the stone to make it into flakes, and then you snap the flakes off, and then you shape them even more, you blunt them, and they get attached to sticks and to bones to make them into arrows and throwing spears. But these are things that are propelled by, you could say, bow and arrows, or these spear throwers that early humans would have had. Now, what's interesting is this kind of technology was known sporadically around 60,000-65,000 years ago in the region, not known really elsewhere in Africa until about 20,000 years later than that. What these guys discovered was essentially evidence of an industry of making these stone weapon tips from 71,000 years ago to 60,000 years ago. Now, that tells you that by the time a lot of the human migration out of Africa occurred, which was sometime after 100,000 years ago, those people would have taken that kind of weaponry with them. And the distinctive sort of effects on these artifacts are very much that they are launched weapons. These are fired light arms, if you like. And they would have encountered, obviously this made them more proficient hunters. They would have been able to take each other out more easily just in sort of group fighting. But they would have rocked up in Eurasia and so on and come across the Neanderthals with what so far we think would have been more advanced weaponry, because I think the Neanderthals only had sort of throwing spears.
Yet another reason we are implicated in their decline. But I suppose, given the number of these things found and the factories, you say, what does it tell us about the people living then? What does it tell us about their evolution at that stage?
Well, this is a really nice thing, because there are some sort of thoughts around that. Although anatomically modern, you may not have got a modern mind in early humans until a long time after this. These implements were found, to say, around 70,000 years ago. But what some of the researchers are arguing is that, well, this really shows that these people were exhibiting very modern mind kind of behaviors, because not only did they have to gather this type of stone, a stone called silcrete, they had to gather wood to burn fires, to heat treat it. They then had to know how to manufacture these. And it would have been over a process of days, weeks, months that this would have happened. Where other more urgent things would have happened, they would have to stop it, put it by the side. So you've got a lot of gathering, you've got a lot of planning, you've got a lot of intention that you're memorizing and remembering. But then also, importantly, you're handing this industry down you're spreading it around to other people in your group, and you're handing it down from generations to generations. And to do this kind of complex thing without language would be very difficult. So they're kind of assuming that this means they had some sort of language, but also just the cognitive abilities you need to do this and sustain it tells you something about the level that their minds had advanced to, how their cognitive abilities at that time. So they may have basically had more modern minds earlier than some scientists think.
Just one more question. These bladelets, you said they were sort of fired from or propelled from wooden throwers. Now, the name of these wooden throwers, how do you pronounce it?
Atlatls.
Atlatl. It just sounds like an atlatl.
That's how I pronounce it.
It sounds like one of those Mars Attacks aliens speaking.
Atlatl.
Anyway, enough of that. Thanks very much, Ian. For more on any of those stories, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science. Chris Turney is a British geologist based at the University of New South Wales in Australia. He's a recent recipient of the prestigious Australian Research Laureate Fellowship, and he's an avid fan of Antarctica. His latest book is a rich history of the scientists and explorers of that continent. In 1912, the world's elite explorers were battling extreme conditions in their race to get to the South Pole. I met Chris to ask him about this great year of scientific adventure. Chris, thank you for coming on the podcast. 1912 is the anniversary of Scott's expedition to the Antarctic, and this has been celebrated in an exhibition at the Natural History Museum. We've done podcast and things about it. Tell us what the context of that expedition was. I mean, what was going on around the same time as Scott getting to the Antarctic?
Yeah, hello, Alec. Antarctica 1912 was really the Edwardian equivalent of space exploration. It was really there at the frontiers. And it was a period when no one really knew what was down south. In fact, if you looked at atlases from over 100 years ago, the bottom third of the southern hemisphere just had unexplored regions stamped all over it, and a few dragons. And for the patriotic atlases, an outline of the British Isles for sense of scale. And people forget that the fact that they tend to sort of imagine it was more about just the race of the pole with Norwegian Roald Amundsen and the British Robert Falcon Scott. But it was really this huge scientific unknown. And the few bits that were known were a few straggling bits of coastline, some ice. And the question was, were these islands? Was it one vast continent covered in a huge dome of ice? Was it sea ice? Was it more than one continent? No one really knew what was down there. So it was this amazing opportunity where the public actually got involved, because as opposed to just for two, there were five expeditions, and they weren't government funded, they were privately funded. And so to get the money from the public, you had to get them excited and engaged. So rather than just going down there doing science, it was this lovely moment. It was a heyday of science communication, but it was also this time where if you were an adventurer, you had to be a scientist to get the stamp of approval to raise the funds. And if you're a scientist, you really had to be an adventurer. And that excited the public tremendously.
So we know about Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton, and the tales of these three adventurous scientists are told endlessly. But let's focus more on the untold stories, which is what your book does. So 1912, your book talks about some of the less famous adventurers who made it to the South Pole. Who was Douglas Mawson, for example? Oh. I've never heard of him.
He's a great guy. In Australia, he's quite well known. He actually was on the $100 bill for a while. So for those very wealthy people, he was a bit of a celebrity. But he was he'd been down with Shackleton a few years before. He was only 28, and he decided he was going to lead his own expedition. Scott tried to poach him, and he wasn't having any of it. He didn't think the South Pole was any had real any scientific value. And he decided to set off on his own. He had the largest group of scientists, and he had a series of research bases, one on Macquarie Island, south of New Zealand, and then two other bases across, well, basically, what was a hypothetical Antarctic coastline. They set off in the boat, the Aurora, and they didn't even know what was there. And they set up a wireless system. They were broadcasting weather observations back to Australia that had an immediate impact on weather forecasting in the region. They took a plane down there. That was quite entertaining. They, it was supposed to be actually a fundraiser, and they flew it down and transported to Adelaide. And they were going to take the Governor General off for a flight. And apparently the pilot got drunk the night before and crashed the thing just before the Governor General.
When was this?
Oh, this was in 1911. Right. Brilliant. So it was.
And you could do this sort of thing back then. There were no drink fly rules.
No. They were good days. So in the end, they stripped the wings off it and took it south, the rest of it, and they called it an air tractor. But these sort of technologies really excited people. Douglas Mawson was just this amazing character who was interested in all sorts of scientific questions. The team he had measured everything from the oceans, on the land, above, into the air. And one of the big unknowns, and had been for a long time, was the fact that the geology and the flora and fauna for a lot of the southern continents looked pretty much the same. And it was very similar anyway. And the idea at the time, this was all pre-plate tectonics, was there'd been these enormous land bridges connecting up all the southern continents, most probably in the area of Antarctica. And then subsequently it sort of sunk below the waves, a sort of modern day Atlantis, really. And so Mawson had this amazing thing that not only did he have his research bases, he had his second in command, Captain John K. Davis, going all the way around the Southern Ocean, making measurements, sounding measurements and collecting samples in the ocean, trying to see if he could find this wretched land bridge that had sunk below the waves, and there was just no evidence of it at all.
These land bridges are one of those mistakes of history for geologists, aren't they? It's a bit like phlogiston for chemists. And
we don't talk
things.
About it.
No, you don't talk about it very much. You do anything you can not to talk about the fact that you didn't once believe in plate tectonics, but let's not go there. So Mawson was obviously a scientist at heart, and he did a lot of science. You mentioned some of the things he did, but did he achieve more scientifically than the ones we know more about, you know, Scott and Amundsen and Shackleton? Amundsen didn't do much science at all.
No, Amundsen did do a fair bit, actually, and there's a fantastic thing in the book where he basically, because of his secrecy, he was going to take an American, Harry Edmonds, a magnetic expert, who was also a doctor. Apparently you did those things together in the old days. And Amundsen eventually just wouldn't tell him he was going south. He was meant to be going north, of course. And Harry Edmonds spat the dummy and never went south in the end. But Mawson arguably did far more than any of the others. There was almost over 80 reports produced, 89 reports that the Australians and New Zealanders produced on all sorts of different things. But alongside all that, Mawson had this tragic experience. He went out with two guys, Ninnis and Mertz. And the three of them went off with dogs, and they were in Adelaide Land in Commonwealth Bay, Cape Denison. And they were meant to be going towards where Scott's team were, and the idea was to join up the coastlines. And 500 kilometres out, Ninnis disappears down the crevasse with basically all the food, the best dogs, and no, they hardly had anything left.
Did he turn back?
Well, basically he did, but they didn't. They had 1.5 weeks' worth of food left, and it's taken them a month to get there. And as they worked back, obviously very upset, they continued to make weather observations every day, even the day Ninnis died. There's weather observations, beautiful stuff. And over time, they had to start eating the dogs. And they didn't realise at the time vitamins hadn't been discovered, and particularly the livers of the dogs is toxic. And over time, their hair started falling out. They became grossly weakened. Mawson's soles of his feet famously fell off. He had to strap them on with lanolin every morning.
The soles of his feet fell off.
Happy.
Gosh.
That's good for marketing, isn't it? And but over time, Mertz eventually degenerated even more rapidly than Mawson. And eventually, in a fit of despair, a fit of insanity, he bit his finger off and died. And so Mawson was left on his own, and he struggled on and on and on, and eventually fell down a crevasse by accident and was flung 5 metres below. And by chance, his sledge had pinned itself on the opposite side, so he managed to sort of crawl himself up a little bit and then fell back down again. It took him 4 hours to get out. And in spite of that, I'd have probably just given up. But at that time, he actually made a ladder, strapped it around himself and the sledge. If he fell down again, he could be able to climb up nonchalantly. And he did that several times. And he kept going. And then about 30 kilometres out, he found a little cairn where there was some food. And he heard that Scott was staying more because we didn't know Scott had died then. And Amundsen had got to the pole. And he found a bit of food. And he couldn't. And the guys had been there just that morning and left the cairn for him. And he was so weakened, he couldn't catch up with them. And he was pushing on because he had to get back before the ship left. And he got to this little ice cave they had called Aladdin's Cave, and he went in and saw pineapple and oranges and thought, oh, thank goodness, the ship's definitely here, it's all okay. But this enormous blizzard kicked in, and it's actually the windiest spot in the world, average wind speeds of 70 kilometres an hour, and he was stuck in this ice cave for 5 days, and it was only 5 kilometres above the base, it was up on the plateau. Eventually, the winds abated, and he put some nails in his shoes and as a crampons, and he was starting to walk down. As he came down the glacier towards his base, he saw smoke on the horizon, and the boat had left that morning. So he's stuck there for another year.
Gosh, I feel ashamed that I've never heard this story before, and I think that everyone should just buy your book and read that just to honour this
it's a
amazing
great story.
Guy. What about some of the other missions that were on at the same time? The Japanese and the Germans were also down there.
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese are a phenomenal story. Almost forgotten, there's a lovely museum there at Nikkō City in northern Japan. They were led by a gentleman called Nobu Shirase. He was an army officer, and he decided to head south as well. And he led a small team down there. They left too late. They came in through Wellington. Everyone thought they were spies because they seemed so badly prepared. And they couldn't get through the sea ice, so their ship was pushed back, and they went into Sydney. And again, everyone thought they were spies, and they put extra sentries on the forts and all the rest of it. But one of the scientists there, Edgeworth David, is one of the great unsung heroes of the time, had been south with Shackleton and calmed everyone down in the papers and said, look, they're not spies, they really are scientists and explorers. And so everyone then went along and had their photos taken with them, and they camped in Sydney over winter in Parsi Bay in Sydney Harbour for a whole winter, and then pushed south again. And as they went down, they collected samples. They very famously interacted in the wildlife in a way that no one had really ever experienced before. There was a wonderful article published in the 1930s by a Norwegian sealer, and he'd written a sort of short synopsis of what they'd done. And one of the things is apparently they'd gone along and stroked penguins' faces, which sounds slightly pervy. but now, more recently, there's been a full publication translation of the diaries. And alongside this, they'd also made a documentary film, almost an hour long. And it now transpires they punched penguins in the face and they filmed it for posterity. So if you're interested, on my website, you can www.christurney.com, you can actually see the movie footage for posterity.
What did the penguins do in return? I hope they bit their hands off.
You'd like to think so. They started to get away, and then they just kept punching them. So anyway, it's all there for posterity, which
God,
is fantastic.
The old days of exploration were a different thing, weren't they?
It's so wrong.
And tell us quickly also about the Germans before we move on to the more modern Antarctic.
No, that's right. The Germans were led by another. It was actually a household name explorer at the time, Wilhelm Filchner. And he was a great contemporary of Scott's as well. He'd actually seen Scott off at Waterloo Station, and they'd agreed plans. They were going to swap equipment. Scott even gave in his motorised sledge designs, and they agreed if they met at the pole, they'd swap colleagues and carry on. But Filchner came down for the Atlantic, and they measured water temperature and salinity, saltiness measurements as they went, and got the first insight into the fact that the Atlantic turned in this massive conveyor belt that we all recognise today. But unfortunately, they couldn't make land, and he had this syphilitic captain who was slightly mad and drunk called Vassal, who sort of divided the whole team, and eventually it was all the Lord of the Flies. Vassal died, and then basically at the end, half the team wouldn't talk to the other, and there's this lovely quote, they got stuck in the sea ice for 8 months, which is effectively what Shackleton had a couple of years later. And there's this wonderful quote in Filchner's diary, says, last night I slept on the floor with my rifle and cartridges in case Dr. Van Girdle tried to shoot me through the wall.
It's completely out of control.
Antarctica was obviously a very, very busy time and full of madcap characters that wouldn't go amiss in some sort of crazy historical film or something. Why did you choose 1912 as the focus for all this? Because this must have all been going on for years before and after too, and well, still going on.
Yeah, well, I think Antarctica is just this incredible place that you can really excite the public about. And in particular, 1912, if you look at the maps before and after, you actually see the shape of a continent as we'd recognise today as a result of all these efforts. And Mawson likened it to a big jigsaw puzzle. Antarctica was the last part that was really missing, and no one really knew what was down there. And because of all these efforts, and Scott famously bringing fossils out that proved that these Antarctica had been linked to these other southern continents, it was a lot of these ideas, the weather observations, the ocean observations, they couldn't really make sense of them, but they were the first ideas that really pulled all this idea together about plate tectonics, the fact that the Earth's atmosphere, the ocean circulation was all linked together, you know, insights which they were struggling to gain from. And it was a magical time for that. And because of the way they raised funds, they excited the public. And I think that's something that we tend to forget now, is we do all this wonderful media. And 100 years ago, they were effectively doing the same thing. They were making the first documentaries, they were sending wireless messages, they were writing books. Shackleton famously did a recording of his voice. You can listen to that online as well. You know, all these things, they did everything they could to engage a public. And because they were raising funds, they took the public with them, which was just magical.
And it wasn't something ancillary to the scientific challenge, because nowadays the research effort in Antarctica is very government funded and robust, and there's lots of people there. I mean, there's people there all the time now, and you're one of them, which we'll ask you about in just a moment. But when you were talking about these missions in 1912, all these people had to raise their own funds, and the public, let's say, outreach part of it was it seen as just part of the actual exercise rather than just a bit on the end with some pretty pictures?
Oh no, it was absolutely integral, because without the public getting engaged, they just wouldn't get the funding to go. And we forget that actually, although there were five down there, there were actually meant to be seven. The Americans were meant to be going south. Robert Perry, who famously claimed the North Geographic Pole, probably didn't get there. And also a Scottish expedition as well, William Spears Bruce. They were both made claims that they were going to head south and go for the pole, but they couldn't raise the funding. So it was absolutely essential you engage the public.
What do you think's up with the modern scientists then in that case?
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with them as such. I think they do wonderful research. I do a little bit.
You do wonderful research and wonderful outreach stuff. I mean, Antarctic scientists are always in the news. Usually for the wrong reasons, because climate change is doing terrible things down there. But do you think that they could be doing more?
Well, I just think it, one of the pleasures of writing a book like this is it gives you a chance to step out of the madness and actually reflect on what's gone before and what lessons we can learn. And I think one of the lovely things they did back then was they did make real efforts to engage the public. I certainly wouldn't want to see it all privately funded. That would be a disaster. But the way that we can engage the public and get them interested, excited in science, rather than telling them, you have to learn science because it's good for you. You'll always get 5-10% of the population, but you won't get the majority. And I think if you can tell the stories of what's been gone before, the history, the ripping yarns, but from the perspective of why the guys were there, you can engage the public.
The adventure and
the science go together. And what's happened really more with regards to Antarctica is not the science as such. I think the way we tell the stories of Antarctica is very much just the ripping yarns, the adventure. And we forget the fact that actually it was all this amazing science they were doing, which is genuinely exciting. I mean, even now, some of the work that they did 100 years ago is giving us insights into what happened back, is happening now, thanks to their efforts 100 years ago.
Let's bring us right up to date then. I mean, you're a rare thing in this podcast where you've actually been to Antarctica. You've probably stepped off the boat minutes ago from there. I don't know how often you go. But what's it like?
You can fall into cliches.
No, do. I think that this is what cliches are made for.
It's just the most mind-blowing blitz on the senses. We've flown in. I've been on the boats to South Georgia, and that's an amazing experience. But I've flown in from southern Chile. And that first time, you read the diaries, you read the books, you're terribly excited about what's going to happen and how you're going to face up to it. And first time when the doors open and you get this blast of cold, brilliant light and air flooding in. And there's this audible gasp from everyone as you realise, gosh, we're here. We're actually in Antarctica. It's like nothing else in the world. And once you start doing field work in particular, and you're with just a couple of friends and colleagues in the middle of nowhere, and probably people are around for 50, 100 kilometres or so, there's this tremendous sense of isolation. And it's also incredibly liberating. And when the wind's not blowing, the stillness is incredible because you can't hear anything. There's not birds in the sky. There's no moisture in the air. It's just effing still. It's almost like a Martian landscape, you sort of imagine. And nothing really prepares you for that. And last time we were down, we actually got to the pole for the centenary of Scott's arrival, which was marvellous, and we were doing some work up there. But we decided we're going to take a satellite system, so we sent up daily movie footage of what we were doing in the field, so you can have a look on that on YouTube. And it's just a lovely way of being able to show people the sort of environment it's like. You can sort of take them a little bit with you.
It's surprising for maybe some people to know that Antarctica is so connected. I mean, it's on the internet, and you can send emails and movie footage and all sorts of things, which helps your case that perhaps scientists should send more information out there for the rest of us to sort of vicariously enjoy it. But the story of Antarctica today is quite a sad one in some respects. It's falling apart because of rising temperatures around the world, and the Southern Ocean is warming, and the work you and your colleagues are doing down there is really incredibly important in helping us monitor climate change. I don't want to take it down a dark road necessarily, because we've had such a great conversation about adventure down there, but what is the state of Antarctica now and in the next few decades in terms of our warming world? And you see it in front of you when you go there. So how does it feel when the rest of the world doesn't take climate change seriously?
Yeah, it's one of these places. It's just a marvellous place to really give you an insight on what the state of the health of our planet is. Not all of it's doom and gloom. And certainly the guys over here, the British Antarctic Survey, for instance, are doing amazing work with that. And it's one of those areas, regions of the world where you can just start seeing some of the first impacts, as you could say, because of warming in some parts. Some parts are cooling as well, actually, as far as we can work out. But it gives you an insight into the sensitivity of our planet. And when you look in the past at when changes have happened, the greatest changes, the largest changes, are happening at high latitudes, so the Arctic and the Antarctic. So if you can get in there, you can get some insight on where these changes are happening, and actually say, hopefully by showing the people this beautiful, pristine environment and showing them how lovely and gorgeous it is, but also how much you can learn about the whole planet just from going to this part of the region, you can actually help educate public and actually hopefully try to change public opinion. This is real. We need to do something about it. And we can make a difference.
What worries you the most about what's happening down there at the moment?
The elephant in the room is sea level rise. That's the big one, and no one knows what's going to happen with that. When you look in the past at, I mean, the book's not like about this at all, but if you look in the past, for instance, 125,000 years or so ago, the last interglacial, when the world was naturally warmer than today because of other processes, sea level was somewhere between 6.5 and 9.5 metres higher than today. And when you do the calculations on what happened to Greenland and what happened to some of the glaciers around the rest of the world, and the expansion of the oceans just because they get warmer, the rest has to come from Antarctica, and we're looking at 3-4 plus metres comes from there. And that's very hard to find without a complete collapse or a very large collapse of ice sheets or a lot of ice going into the ocean. The question is, how quickly did it happen, and where the tipping points are in the system? Where does the warming have to reach a point where the system spins out of control? And we don't know at the moment. And that's one big area of research that we're actively looking at now. We just don't know.
Now, 100 years after Scott, it looks like the legacy of that work, the British Antarctic Survey, might be under threat, bizarrely. It looks like it might be folded into various other government departments. I mean, why is it important that the British Antarctic Survey, for example, and organisations like it need to continue for the work that you're talking about? I mean, you work in Australia now, but you must have colleagues all over the world who... And the BAS is one of the most important and famous of these institutions. And why does it need to still exist?
Because of this special place in Antarctica, you need a very targeted focus. You need people who are experts across a whole range of sciences. And that's all the way through from the geology, the biology, the oceanography, and the atmosphere. And the great thing about the British Antarctic Survey, I'm not familiar with the full details, but the great thing about the team that they've got there is they span all the different sciences. And so what you can do is you can have links between these synergies, I hate that sort of term, but these links between these guys where you can actually connect the response of biology to the climate forcing, to the ocean changes, the ocean acidification alike, which you can't get by having them in disparate groups. And that's the great thing about that. And, those teams, Australian Antarctic Division alike, and there's all sorts of Antarctic groups all around the world, and they all just do great things. And when you're actually down there, there's a tremendous sense of collaboration, because I think you're in such an extreme environment as well. You see these lovely connections all the time. Teams meet up, they help each other out. These ideas are being bounced around all the time, and then they communicate that to the wider public. So they're a very special Antarctic community. It's just a magical place to work.
Chris, one final thing. Can you get us to Antarctica? me and a radio producer. That's all we need.
That's why not. We'll get a boat. We'll start tonight.
You can probably commandeer a boat from somewhere, can't you?
Oh, no worries at all.
Wonderful. Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks a lot.
1912, the year the world discovered Antarctica, is out now and available in all good bookshops on and offline. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian Masterclasses are now accessible as video downloads and streams. For Science Weekly listeners, we have a special offer on the great science writer Tim Radford's Masterclass. Normally £3 to stream or £5 to download, we are offering 10% off, and all you have to do is use our Science Weekly discount code, SCIENCESAVE, all one word. To avail of the offer, just go to the Guardian Masterclasses at guardian.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.